Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm Dave Speck and joining me is news editor Will Stewart. Hi, Will.
Hello.
We've got deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Mary Louise, hello.
Hi there.
We've got our North of England reporter John Roberts. John, hi.
Hello there.
We've got reporter Catherine Luff, GCSE's expert. Catherine, hi.
Hello. Hi.
We've got our brilliant journalist, Amy Gibbons. Amy, hello.
Hello.
It's been a very eventful week, again, with plenty of news, as ever. And a TES investigation has today revealed that one in three schools have now been hit by the virus. Amy and John, this is data you've collected from local authorities, isn't it, Amy?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So we went to all of the local authorities with responsibility for schools in their area and asked them how many schools had been hit by the virus since the start of term. And the figure that we got back from 62 councils who did get back to us was roughly one in three, which obviously is pretty big proportion. So the exact figures were the COVID-19 cases had been recorded in 35% of schools across those 62 areas since the start of the academic year. And that at least one in four schools had COVID cases in October alone, which was also, you know, showing that the problem was continuing as the months go on. There was also some kind of disparity between different regions within England, which we were able to sort of figure out from the various councils that did get back to us and where they were. So pretty bleak situation, as you might imagine, in the north of England, specifically in a couple of places like in Middlesbrough in the northeast. 50 of the 53 schools in the area had COVID cases. That's 94% of schools, which is obviously huge. And then there was, you know, differences elsewhere. So the lowest proportion of schools with COVID was the Isle of Wight with just 6%. So it shows this massive difference depending on where you are in the country. And John, I know, spoke to Nick Brook from the NAHT, the School Leaders Union, a bit about it. And he had some interesting stuff to say, didn't you, John?
Well, John, yeah, I was going to ask you, what was the reaction to these findings?
Well, like Amy says, I think perhaps the most striking thing is the disparity. Obviously, we know COVID is higher than it's been for a long time, so it's no surprise to see it impacting on schools. But I think the thing that people reacted to is the fact that it isn't a kind of a level playing field. You've got some schools, I think we found 20 odd where the majority of schools in an area had it, and then equally there was another group of authorities where it's less than 20%. And what Nick Brook basically said was that this shows the problem that the government has with kind of trying to keep up with league tables and also not having a firm plan for exams yet in terms of taking into account these issues. Yeah. And I think his point, and it's one they've made before, but on the back of our data is, this is exactly what we said would happen. The impact on schools isn't even, it's not a level playing field. So how can you have a performance measure at the end of the year where, you know, some schools have had COVID cases and kids in and out and others haven't? It becomes a kind of a meaningless measure. So that's one thing. And then we also spoke to the Northern Powerhouse Partnership, their director, Henry Murison, and he basically took up the issue of the... I mean, it's more complex than the north-south divide, but certainly, as all things always are, but certainly it's true to say that the majority of areas that were hardest hit were in the north in terms of those where three-quarters of schools or more were had COVID cases. And he basically, again, pointed out that this shows the flaw in having exams this year as normal, and that it will disadvantage schools. The other thing I think that kind of jumps out in the data, because we've got data from more than 60 authorities all told, is that basically of those hardest hit, there's 10 in the north and another 8 in London, and that accounts for like 18 of the 22. And it just struck us looking at it, that a lot of urban centres seem to be hard hit and some more rural authorities in the south less so, which is unsurprising, but the data really lifts a lid on the extent to which how that plays out in schools.
It was a real split. There was a bit of a split in London though as well, wasn't there?
Absolutely.
Was it Kensington, Chelsea had very low figures compared to what were the high?
Yeah, absolutely. So some authorities only gave us, so we've kind of had a big data draw twice this year, and some authorities we only got data for September, and Kensington was, and Chelsea was one of those. But yeah, their numbers were less than 5%. Newham,
so for example in East London the figure was 80%, which is completely the other end of the scales. As John says, obviously we've got some data just for September, but there is certainly indications there that even within kind of the more urban areas there's a big spread.
And there's a lot of people, I saw on Twitter this morning a lot of teachers reacting, saying, you know, where are the figures from our authority, or, you know, saying there's a lot more schools than this. I mean, hopefully by the time people are listening to this, we will have actually done a follow-up looking at that issue. But I think it's worth saying we can only publish the figures that local authorities gave us, and then so we're limited to that. But it could be, I guess it could be the tip of the iceberg, could it?
What we do know is we've got responses from 60 councils. It's just over a third of the councils in England. So there is a lot more data out there that we'll kind of aim to bring in. And potentially there are some areas missing. So for example, places like Liverpool, who didn't come back to us, where we know rates of COVID are obviously very high. And it's quite likely that there will be lots of schools affected in those areas too. So what we're going to do is see what we can find out, maybe go back to a couple of those areas and see what we can get. So I think there's definitely more data to be had, but from the percentage that we've got, we've certainly got some interesting kind of early indications of how bad the situation could be.
It does help make the argument for what people are saying about exams and how something should be brought in to recognise these regional disparities, which...
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, we spoke to Kate Green, the Shadow Education Secretary, yesterday, and she told us that she believes that there may need to be some sort of regional dimension when it comes to the way results are graded. I mean, the word she actually used was norm-referenced. But she said it could be sort of similar to the contextualisation of results that happens for pupils who've been on long-term illness, for example. But she said, you know, it's very much under discussion with regional and local governments, and you know, a consultation process needs to happen before any of this can go ahead. But I was going to ask you, Catherine, because you're aware of discussions of this ilk already taking place in exam boards. Is that right?
Yes, it is. So I think, I was speaking to the chief executive of AQA, Colin Hughes, and he said that is something that's being discussed. I think there are issues with it, because he kind of pointed out that even where a region has been really hard hit, there will be kind of pockets within that region that might have, you know, not really experienced very many closures and might have actually had really good provision throughout this time, and others that have been really, really badly affected. So I think it would be difficult to do, and it'd be difficult to define sort of exactly where the need was for that special consideration. But it is being considered, because I suppose, you know, as Amy and John's investigation shows today, there are some councils where they are seeing, you know, really, really sort of serious repercussions from this and a lot of lost learning time.
Sounds like a real can of worms, though.
I mean, it really sounds
like an easy kind of solution to suggest, but, you know, how would you do it without, well, as the AK, you know, Colin Hughes was saying, if you're in a school that hasn't been disrupted within a region that has, then you there's going to be huge unfairness.
You're going to get an unfair advantage, aren't you?
Yeah.
He said something which quite interesting, which was sort of that you know, the exams can't be, that the system is going to be very unfair this year, and they're going to do kind of everything they can, and there are obviously lots of options being looked at, like optionality, like possibly having a series of mock exams before the papers, reserve papers afterwards. But he sort of said as well, you know, that it's, you can't completely twist the exam series to accommodate what has happened to that cohort. Like in a way, it's not the mechanism to solve those unfairnesses, which I think, and he was sort of talking about, you know, putting in extra support for the cohort, you know, for the next couple of years, but that there might be other ways of doing that aside from kind of really shifting the goalposts where exams are concerned.
Yeah, and we said it before, but where do you shift them to? You know, do you use last year as your marker, but then that's unfair to the year before? Mm.
It really is a concern. And I think, you know, that also came up this week with the Education Select Committee, where Robert Halfen was sort of talking about, you know, not baking in inflation into the grading process as well. Obviously, we had the, you know, higher generally teacher assess grades in 2020, and he was sort of pointing out that if you do that again, you are effectively kind of embedding sort of quite a bit of grade inflation into the system. And then it's kind of like, well, does that go on to 2022, who could also as a cohort have an argument that they've been affected by this? So it's I think it is one that they need to consider in terms of sort of, you know, how long does the exam system accommodate what's happened with the pandemic.
Another one of your stories, Catherine, this week was the lack of invigilators for next year's exams, or a shortage of invigilators, and that could even jeopardize their even going ahead, could it?
I think so this is that's the other kind of the practical side of things. I suppose, you know, we don't know what's going to have happened with the pandemic by the exam series next year, and I think that you know, everyone's preferred option in terms of in the discussion seems to be very much for the exam to go ahead, but there are questions obviously about how many markers there will be, how many invigilators there will be, particularly because a lot of those people will often be retired teachers, and they won't be, you know, in terms of their age will make them vulnerable. They won't want to come in to schools to invigilate papers. So those are some of the kind of practical problems that they might run into later next year.
Yeah.
I think quite a few teachers do probably want them cancelled by now, don't they, from certain bits of the country. Yeah, I think you're right. There's a big push for exams from Gavin Williamson, and it feels like quite a split.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think in terms of sort of, I would say kind of Ofqual, the DfE, that they, I think there is definitely a push there for them to go ahead. But you're right that for teachers, obviously also they're seeing how far pupils might be behind as well firsthand. And you know, that there is definitely a sense of that, the idea that it would still be very unfair to get that cohort to sit sort of exams in a kind of full series as normal next year.
You can imagine, can't you? If you look at like what happened this summer, fast forward to next summer, and you've got young people who grew up in a part of the country where they've been hammered by COVID, been in and out of school, they didn't get the grades they need for whatever version of the exams we end up with. It's going to be probably worse, I think, than last year in some ways. Because last year you had the sense that the whole cohort was dumped in the same situation. But this one, you're trying to have a level playing field with like an infinite number of different scenarios. And whoever misses out, and there will be kids who miss out, are going to be able to say that this was unfair. I think it's kind of now essentially a choice between bad options, and whatever they arrive with, people who don't get the results they need are going to think it was an injustice.
I agree.
I think that it's sort of something that in a way it isn't really solvable in terms of making it completely fair for all pupils. I think it is an interesting idea, that idea that you could do special consideration by kind of on a regional basis, but I think that is the only thing, is that it would be quite a kind of broad brush way of doing things, where, you know, within a region, kind of as you're you know, as Amy was saying, even with London, you've got Newham, you've got Kensington and Chelsea, the picture there is really, really different, and so it's quite hard to do, I think, to sort of say that, you know, there's just an entire region should get their marks adjusted upwards.
Although they've decided in Wales that the situation is so that exams need to be cancelled, haven't they? So that's another kind of fly in the ointment in terms of, you know, pupils next year and teachers next year sort of will be saying, if they do sit exams, what kind of, if the disruption in Wales was such that, that exams couldn't go ahead, kind of what's different in a worse effect, a badly affected Welsh town compared to one of the cities or towns in the north.
And does that make for fair competition, you know, if students in, depending on what the situation is for awarding grades in Wales, is it really fair for them to be competing for certain things with students who did sit exams in other forms in England? That's another question I think I've seen raised. There's some concern that it might not be completely fair going forward.
Depends what they end up with, doesn't it? Because if in Wales, well, presumably they will end up with GCSE and A-level grades. So to an extent, they might be an advantage. But I mean, other people were suggesting, oh, it's going to devalue them. That, you know, if you're an employer and they know you took your GCSEs in 2021 and you're in Wales, and people are just going to go, oh, we didn't sit the exam. I'm not entirely sure that would work. I don't think people think like that, do they? I think they look at the basics. They look, you know, have you got a grade? I'm going to show my age. I was going to say grade C, but you know, a grade four in English and maths, and that's it. But yeah.
The other factor teachers thinking about, I was talking to a teacher the other day who was saying, well, but the impact on pupils in terms of being engaged with schooling, it could be quite huge. He was saying that as soon as it was announced that exams were cancelled this year in 2020, then that there was just sort of, he witnessed just a mass disengagement in March. But obviously it would be very different this year if it was announced at this point of the year, because obviously they're still going to be assessed, and well, it would depend on how they would do it. But yeah.
That was exactly what Amanda Spielman said, wasn't it? She said pupils wouldn't even come into school. She suggested pupils would stop coming to school if you cancelled exams.
Mm. Yeah.
And all this is no doubt possibly one of the factors why you've got hundreds of older experienced teachers calling up the advice line of the NEU teaching union every day asking, how can I get out? How can I make my pension work? Which
that was a very slick link. That was brilliant. couldn't see the joy.
But I mean, listen, what other profession would have you got where you've got hundreds of people lining up to leave every day? And that it seems astonishing, but that is what's happening in teaching, because the NEU tell us they get thousands of calls every day to their advice line. It's a huge rise on last year before coronavirus, and they've had to expand their advice line for this reason. And you've got hundreds of teachers are sort of in the 50 plus bracket trying to make their pensions work, and they're dischuffed about this year's pay deal. That's one of the reasons that they want to leave.
You should say that this is another story we ran this week. This is your story, Dave, based on your interview with the president of the NEU.
Yeah, Robin Bevin, we had a chat on the phone, yeah. I'm hopefully going to see more of Robin next few weeks when we profile him. He's the new president of the NEU. But yeah, I mean, some of the things he told, I mean, the word he used was that all the teachers are pissed off with this year's pay award. I mean, they got 2.75% increase compared to a 5.5% increase for new teachers, and that, I mean, that's already been described as a kick in the teeth. But, I mean, what sort of made me sort of raise an eyebrow was that at the same time, the DfE is doing this, commissioning this piece of research into whether this year's pay deal has had any unintended impacts on the retention of experienced teachers. Well, you only need to chat to Robin at the NEU to find out that is absolutely the case, and that it's having a negative effect.
I thought his point that was very interesting, what he was saying about younger teachers, because the whole point of this pay deal is to address the recruitment problem and to make it more competitive at the younger end. But what was he saying, Dave? He was basically saying that you've got
artificial.
I remember the word. Did he say forced retention or artificial retention?
Because
of the pandemic.
Yeah,
basically
the job market has collapsed under COVID, as he described it. And so you've got teachers who can't activate their pension are staying in the job, even though they don't want to. It's a process of artificial retention.
So basically, the whole kind of rationale behind doing this pay deal and kind of loading it towards younger teachers has disappeared because of coronavirus. So you don't actually, if you're being hard-headed about it, obviously younger teachers would want more money, but in terms of recruitment, you probably don't need to do it anymore because there's fewer options. So,
what they should have done.
But at the same time, yeah.
Was to give all the teachers a decent pay rise, because you know you've only got to look at the DfE annual report from last week, Mary Louise. Me and you spotted this, didn't we? That they've highlighted the fact that the lack of experienced teachers is posing a high risk to a quality education for all children. That was said in the DfE annual report last week.
Yeah, exactly.
Good job they got some up to cheer them up tonight, though.
These links, so you're outdoing yourself with these links, I tell you. But it is the Oscars of the education sector tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We've got the TES Awards, and Mary Louise, come on, you know all about these awards, do you?
We all do. We're all really excited.
We're all going as well. You see us all there.
We'll all be there. Yeah. No, I'm Chief Sparkle and Awards correspondent today. So yes, this is education's biggest party, but this year you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to go and get your dinner jacket from the dry cleaners and find it doesn't fit from last year, whatever, as some people were tweeting. You can just put your bubbles in the fridge and settle down on the sofa. The entertainment's going to be brought to you, and you can see the best and the brightest of education and schools. We'll find out who's going to win their awards. There are 18 awards, so we've got the School of the Year, we've got Secondary School of the Year, Head Teacher of the Year, as everyone probably well versed. Some amazingly sort of high quality entries as ever. So it'd be really interesting to see who's announced on the night. And we've actually got none other than Alan Dedicote, the voice of Strictly Come Dancing and the National Lottery, who's going to be announcing the winners and doing the voiceover. And also on top of that, we're also going to be joined by the cast of The Lion King. So it's set to be a wild night.
What's happening? What time's it on?
It's on at 8 o'clock, from 8 till 9 tonight.
And how can people get on it? Is it live on YouTube?
Yeah, so you need to register. So check the TES Twitter feed, or go to let me just bring up the so it's the TESAwards.co.uk, and you can register on that, and you'll be sent a link to get online.
Brilliant. We'll see you all there. Let's leave it there and we'll see you all tonight.
See you there.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.